welcome. Now that I'm up here, I don't know which side is the goats. Because when I was sitting down, it was different, but now it's, I don't know. We'll work that out. Deuteronomy chapter 7 is where we're going to have our study this evening. I'm glad you're here. I hope you've taken a little bit of time to see the text, notice some of the things that are there, and hopefully we'll draw out some things that will be helpful for us. This study has convinced me of something I heard. You know, every part of the Bible is useful to everybody. And sometimes you think about that and you go, well, I don't know about all the names, you know, or the big genealogies and sections of Leviticus. And you're like, what does this have to do with me? You do find connections, even to things that are that you never knew were there that matter today. And that's what's been really great about this study. Anyway, let's start with chapter 7. We always start with what we see when we read the text. So we want to begin with sort of just our summary. What do we see when we get there? This is in the middle of the second sermon that Moses is preaching. He is leading the way eventually into getting into the retelling of the law. We've already had so far the retelling of the Ten Commandments. There's going to be a bit of a history lesson coming up in the next few chapters. And then once we get, down around to, I think, chapter 12, somewhere in that range, maybe a little further along, we get to some more laws. But tonight, we're in chapter 7. What do you see there in the first five verses of the chapter? What are they told to do?
The Lord gave them the land, delivered the people, get rid of.
Those people have to go, right? And that's excellent. It's a good way to summarize that first section. Why would they have to go? Other than the classic, because God said so. Because God does supply a reason in this section. They are going to turn your sons away from following me to serve other gods. It's not just go wipe them out because I don't like them. There was always usually two good reasons for why God established holy war, where they would go in and just wipe folks out. One of them was to prevent temptation to turn away from God. And the other one, which isn't mentioned here, is a judgment of the nation itself. Okay, if the nation was wicked, God would judge them, and he does that repeatedly in the Old Testament. That reason is not given here, but that is common for this sort of warfare. When they go to destroy them, how are they going to, to what degree are they going to do that?
Utterly.
Completely, utterly, all of them. They have got to go, unless the Lord's anger is kindled against you. And notice at the end of verses like 4 and 5, he takes special note to make sure you destroy every aspect of their idol worship. Okay, a lot of these things they would build, or the Asherim, were connected with either the male or the female deity. And specifically, the Asherah was the female version of what they were worshiping. Some other versions were male, and some things would happen there. Go and kill all of it, right? Chop it down, burn it down, get rid of everything. We have sort of the negative, here's why you're going to do this, in terms of you're going to turn our sons away. But in the next section, you get the positive side. Like, here's who you're supposed to be. What do you see there from 6 down to 11? Verse 6 is a really key verse in chapter 7.
For God's chosen people, so they should
pray. Yes. You're God's chosen people. You need to act that way. You need to be holy to the Lord. You remember, be holy as I am holy, which Peter's going to quote later on in 1 Peter. You all, in terms of Israel, they were chosen to be a people for his treasured possession, right? The inheritance of God. They were supposed to be his people. The reason why they were this way was not because they've earned it somehow, not because they were the best, not because they were the biggest, anything like that. Why was it that they were given their status? Yeah, because God loves you. Because God, you could say God chose you to be this, right? Later on, Paul's going to reuse that language of choosing or election and love and hate. When he uses it, it's not a matter of God emotionally loves or emotionally hates. It's a matter of choice. God chose Israel above all other nations to fulfill his purpose. Who has God chosen today?
Christians.
And who can become a Christian? Anyone. That's the difference, right, between then and now. Anybody can submit to Christ in faith, right, and obey the gospel. And God has chosen those who would, out of every nation, to be his people, to be his new Israel going forward. But here at the beginning of the conquest, they have to act as if they are God's people. You get a repetition of something that's said about God a little later in that section. We'll maybe come back around to it. Okay, 12 through 16. What do you see there? Absolutely. And some of the details of that are pretty amazing. When you read down through that section, he's going to bless the fruit of your womb, the fruit of the ground, grain, wine, and oil, increase of the herds and the young of the flock. You'll be blessed above all peoples, no male or female barren among you or your livestock. All the sicknesses, all the evil diseases of Egypt are going to be gone, and they're going to be put on those who hate them. It's pretty incredible. Yes, sir. Absolutely. Here's what's going to happen if you are my people. There is a responsibility that's laid at the end of that section around verses 15 and 16. What is that? We have the benefits or the blessings of being God's people, but there comes with it a responsibility. What are they called to do again? They're called to honor the law. Absolutely right. And they're around 15 and 16. Consume them, right? Destroy. Consume is completely gone, right? It's not leave a little, you know, leftovers. It's completely gone, right? Neither shall you serve their... You're not going to pity them, for they're going to be a snare to you. All right. 17 through 26. Kind of a big chunk, so you can give me anything out of that section, but what did you notice in there? That fear that this said that they had, these nations are greater than I, how can I dispossess them? Does that sound familiar? It should. It's Numbers chapter 13 and 14, the issue of the 10 spies. You know, we look like grasshoppers to them, and that's what they thought of us, you know, they said. So Moses comes back around to a familiar thought. Lest you say, how can we do this? What's the answer to how can we do this? God's doing it. Remember, right? Remember specifically there what he did to Pharaoh. Remember what he did to Egypt. God's going to do this to all the people of whom you are afraid, it says there. I love the way that's phrased there. The people of whom you are afraid in the ESV. He gives them a little bit of how he's going to work through this. It's not going to be just, you know, one swipe and they're all gone. It's going to happen by stages, by process. The way God conquers is, in this case, it's according to a plan. Okay, it's not just, you know, willy-nilly go wherever. There's thought behind this. They're not going to make an end of them all at once. They're going to make their name perish from under heaven. What are they going to do to the idols and to the devoted things again?
Burn.
That last section, say 25 through 26, somewhere in there. They're going to burn with fire. They're not going to covet the gold or silver that's in them. Does that sound familiar? That's what Achan did in Judges chapter 6. Joshua chapter 6. Achan does exactly this. Jericho was to be placed under the ban. The idea of the ban, or the Hebrew word for it is harem, I think it is when God says destroy it all completely. It's literally like offering the place as a sacrifice. Right? Everything has to go. Jericho was to be placed under the ban, and that's where Achan fell short. Not everywhere in Canaan was like this. Okay, there were some different, you know, types of things, but by and large, that was the case. Jericho is our big example of it. I love how at the end of that section, the end of chapter 7, lest you be ensnared by it, for it is an abomination to the Lord. Right? And then he says it again, you shall not bring an abominable thing into your house. There's often you find this, some call it poetic justice, some call it eye for an eye, like the thing that you were supposed to do is going to happen to you if you disobey, right? That sort of what you, like, you're afraid of them, they're going to be afraid of you, right? You destroy them or you're going to be destroyed like them. And you see that at the end of 7. If you bring the abominable thing into your house and become devoted to destruction like it, right? The thing that was supposed to happen to it will happen to you if you bring it in. That's a common sort of thing you see. Okay, cool. Chapter 7, that's what you see. A big theme in the end of 7, what God did before, he's going to do it again. He's proven himself with Egypt and the plagues and so forth. He's going to do it again when they come into Canaan. He's going to be capable of that. All right, chapter 8. 8's a lot shorter than 7, so only two sections here. First 10 verses. What do you see? And how did that go? How's it described? You're exactly right. He took care of them for 40 years in a rather special way. Their clothes and their shoes didn't wear out. Their clothes and their shoes. 40-year shoes. Yeah, well, they kind of brought that on themselves, sure. They were fed with, someone called it miracle bread. And they're not wrong. It's bread that fell every morning, 6 days a week. That all they had to do was go out and pick it up. That sounds like miracle bread. They were wearing miracle clothes and miracle shoes. Because their shoes and their clothes not wearing out for 40 years is nothing short of a miracle. That God made that happen for them. What was the point of all that? The bread and the shoes and the clothes. What was the lesson?
Humility.
Yeah. I've humbled you, and you need me.
Man does not live by bread.
Another familiar phrase, Matthew chapter 4, where Jesus quotes from when he's speaking with the devil, specifically about turning the stones to bread. Okay, it's an important lesson that Israel learned. The reason why they were who they were is not because of luck or because of their greatness or power or whatever. It was because God made it so. And he proves it in the wilderness. He proved that point on the way to Mount Sinai and on the way to Canaan. He provided in that period as well. But then when they sinned and they were forced to wander for 40 years, his protection and his providence continued. And he overwhelmingly proved his point. I am with you. I'm going to defend you. One thing I skipped over, and I didn't do a good job of this. If you are describing to a nation of people in this period of time the perfect scenario, right? Or we'll just call it heaven. What types of things would you say to an agricultural society? You would tell them, you're going to have crops and they're going to be abundant. All of your animals, they're going to have lots of other little animals. And there's not going to be any who can't have animals. Oh, and by the way, that includes you too. You're going to have lots of little Israelites running around. And I'm going to provide you with all of these different sorts of things. The oil, think about olive oil and grain and wine. You get another one of those in chapter 8. There's two heavenly descriptions, quote, heavenly descriptions of Canaan. I think the one in chapter 8 is the most descriptive that we find anywhere. It's called a land of milk and honey in other places, but this one in chapter 8 is special, okay? They're going into a good land. Moses said repeatedly in the first sermon, I can't go to the good land, right? And he sees that repeated here. A land of brooks of water and fountains and springs flowing out in the valleys and hills. Where have they been wandering for 40 years? A wilderness. A place not without water, but it's certainly scarce. And on at least a couple of occasions, God provided it miraculously. You're going to a place with water everywhere. Right? Sounds heavenly. A land of wheat and barley and vines and fig trees and pomegranates and olive trees and honey. You don't get a better description of Canaan than this one. A land in which you'll eat bread without scarcity, which you will lack nothing. And then a detail that's unique to this account, if I remember right. Not just agricultural success. What else is in Canaan?
Iron
and copper. Extremely valuable things, right? Even today. Copper is still mined in that part of the world, Saudi Arabia and so on. You're going to a place where you will need nothing. The end of that description in verse 10, you shall eat and be full. You know, that's when God says you're going to eat and be full. That's a hard blessing to beat. And you get another, as he did before, so he'll do again sort of thing. Okay, last section, 11 through 20. What do you see? Sure. Yes.
To this is that they would bless God.
Yes.
That are, you know, I think it reinforces the idea that God does for us, and this is our response, right? Our response is to bless, to honor, to be devoted to Him. You know, our services respond with gratitude, our service is not under duress.
Yes. It's an excellent point. And it reminds me of, you know, the phrase, the Lord's commands are not burdensome. We sometimes look at the law and we say, that's a big burden to carry. And certainly it would have been difficult to do the things in the law. But compared to this, I mean, compared even to other Canaanite gods, Israel, God's not asking for, you know, like slavery. He's taking you to a place where you're going to need nothing and be blessed beyond your wildest dreams, and he's asked you to keep his covenant and bless him for it. You know, it's a situation of benevolence and, you know, wanting to dwell peacefully with his people. It's sort of a repetition of the Garden of Eden. God's trying to bring them back to some form of the garden, a place of, you know, where they have everything they want. There to be to dwell with God. It's a heavenly sort of thing.
The heading of, in my mind, of course, added by others, but it says God's gracious dealings, first chapter 8, and you can see this in point this was made previously by you, that they didn't do anything to earn or, you know, really to even justify this gift of God's love.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's where it comes to humility. You know, that you didn't do anything, you know, to prompt this. This is my love for you, but your response is this.
Absolutely. They have to respond properly. And it's funny, you mentioned headings, and so I thought, what does it say in my Bible? So I flipped it over, and I think it said, remember the Lord your God, which is, what is it that can happen? We're just going to lead it into the next section. What is it that can happen when you eat and become full?
Look at what I have done.
Yeah. Man, look how good we have it. Look how good I'm doing for myself, right? I'm doing for myself. And you forget the difficult times. You forget what it was like, you know, in that period of want and utter absolute dependence on God. And it happens, and you're tempted to it when God blesses you. And that, maybe that's a bad way of putting it. The blessings that God blesses you with can in turn become a hindrance, you know. Yes, sir. Hey, amen. You're exactly right. You know, sometimes you hear the phrase "the greatest nation on earth," and I, you know, tend to probably agree. You know, in a lot of ways, but that comes with a tremendous temptation. You know, that hey, look at us. You know, look how well we're doing. We are people who eat and are full constantly, several times a day, usually several. Some times a day, it depends. That is an absolutely dangerous temptation for us. They're supposed to take care in verse 11 of chapter 8, lest you forget the Lord your God. Right. Lest, it says a little later on, when you've eaten and are full, you built good houses and live in them, herds and flocks multiply, silver and gold is multiplied, and all that you have is multiplied, then your heart's lifted up, and you forget the Lord your God. Oh, I'm going to read this, see if it sounds familiar. You forget the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. Does that sound familiar? That's the opening line of the Ten Commandments, right? I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house. It, or very nearly the opening line, right? God says, when you eat and are full, you're going to forget item number one. Literally, line number one. I am the Lord your God. Right? It's a temptation. It's a dangerous one. There's another temptation. Beware lest you say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. Okay? If they forget, what will happen? Yep. And then what? You will surely perish. So not just you may, or you know, be careful lest you will perish. Remember I mentioned to you the poetic justice? The thing that's supposed to happen to them will happen to you. You see that at the end of chapter 8 as well. It says there, like the nations that the Lord makes to perish before you, so shall you perish, it says. The thing that was supposed to happen to them is going to happen to you. The judgment that they were going to get, you're going to get. Yes, sir. I like where that thought's going in terms of it not happening immediately. Why doesn't it happen immediately? He's long-suffering. He's patient. He's merciful, right? He could have very well just, you know, said with Adam and Eve and started over, but he didn't. When Israel sinned at Sinai, he could have very well said, you know, and even told Moses, listen, I'm going to start over with you. But he didn't, right? Israel's going to get to the land of Canaan and within a generation begin to forget him. He could have done the same thing, just stopped it right there. But he doesn't. There's this character of long-suffering and mercy of God that's, frankly, it's just difficult to understand. It's difficult to get your brain around, like, why? You know. But that's part of it. That's part of who we're dealing with when you talk about God. But, yeah, his long-suffering is outstanding. Okay. So, what'd you see other than just what's there? What'd you notice as you went through? This is always, I think, the most fun section because you read through and you see, you catch something new every time, right? You rarely go fishing and catch the same fish twice. Same thing when you read the Bible, right? What did you see? Yes, sir.
Repetition of Lord your God 23 times, and then in verse 7 and 9 it says, Lord your God is God.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he references of what's going to happen later, right? Only it's a matter of doubt. It's just a matter of this will happen, and he knows that. Quick reminder. So when you see Lord in all uppercase, what does it mean? It's the tetragrammaton. It's the name of God. It's Yahweh, right? And Yahweh, well, as we think it's pronounced, is connected to God's what? Like, what about God is that name connected to, usually? You remember? The I Am, it's typically related to the idea of covenant, right? Of promises, of this is a God who has put himself with those people. It's a name that God didn't reveal until there were Israelites, right? And he entered into promises with them and covenants with them and began using this name, Yahweh, with them. It's connected to promises. And that's a big point in this section. You said, what, 23 times? So 23 times, every time God's name is used in that way, this idea of covenant and promises. We're talking a lot about covenant and promises here.
In 7 and 9, he does mention that faithful God keeps covenants, that's what, so he's keeping the covenant.
His name is literally connected with who he is and what he does. And then you remember God is Elohim, is usually the idea of creator. It's a little more of a general phrase. But yeah, when you see that, keep in mind covenant, because that's when he started using it, is when he started entering into covenant with Israel. Yes, ma'am. Absolutely. When you think about the wilderness with us, the wilderness is our journey. We're all eventually headed to Canaan. We're headed to Promised Land, right? The land that is amazing beyond degree. And along the way, we get tested. We get tried. That idea is brought up again in the New Testament, that God is testing us. He's giving us trials to humble us and to show us that we still need Him. I can't tell you the irony of someone pulling out their phone and getting on Facebook and complaining about how bad things are. But it happens here and other places. But yes, sir.
Just in terms of key ideas, this has been expressed before, and I talked about this the last time, but it repetitiously describes this is a people who will have a special your point of sometimes we don't understand why he's long suffering. Because sometimes we forget the context of this, like we're even better when we look at our own children.
Yes.
We're long suffering with them because we love them. They're a part of us.
Mm-hmm.
They are a part of God. They are his children. So that is why he's long suffering. And that's why he doesn't destroy them. That's why it's important to them.
Right.
And he's trying to protect them from utter destruction of themselves.
Yeah.
Everything else, much like we try to protect our children, very limited time.
You're exactly right. What you said reminded me when, in terms of he's doing it for their own good. He's trying to protect them. Just earlier in chapter 6, right at the end of the chapter, Moses says, the Lord commanded us to do all these statutes to fear the Lord our God for our good always, that he might preserve us alive. Right? It is for their own good. This is the way they're meant to be. It's God wants them to fulfill what they're supposed to be, not be dragged down or something like that.
The thing is, you have this contrast, the I am God and the covenant of Yahweh, and they're the same God.
Mm-hmm.
Opportunity to be right and still did not destroy.
he is. And yet you think about, because we study in the Bible so much and we read of what God did to the nations, he was very narrow in his approach. He picked not the biggest people on the face of the earth, but a rather small group of people, took them to a rather small piece of land so that he could accomplish the goal of Jesus that would benefit the world. He didn't take a piece of dirt the size of Russia. And he could have. He didn't. Just, I don't know. The more you study and the more you think about what God did and the way he did it, the more you have to be impressed by it. You can't come away from it going, well, he's just malicious. He's just going around just killing it. He's not. It's not the way that he works. But yeah, absolutely. Those are fantastic comments. We always run out of time on Bible study. I hate that, but it is what it is. Some things that I saw, and just these may be helpful for you. These may be some things you notice as well. I already mentioned one of them, the two sort of heavenly descriptions of Canaan. I thought those stood out to me a lot. There were a lot of phrases in this section that are repeated later on in the New Testament, like the one we mentioned from Matthew 4, and we'll get to that in a moment. Moses' concern in this whole thing is that they be faithful. And it's God's concern that they be faithful. Later, earlier in the book, remember, God says, I wish they had a heart like this always, to be like this, for their own good. This is what parents say of their children, right? Parents say of their children, I wish they would walk the straight path, not because, well, I'm going to be feeling better in the morning, but it's better for them, right? It's better for my kids if they do this. And you think about how much that's scaled up with God. He's worried about their faithfulness. Tom Holly said one time, if you picked up the book of Jeremiah and squeezed it, you would get judgment, right? It would just drip out of the pages. And that image of just picking up Bible passages and squeezing them to see what would come out stuck with me. If you did that with this section, what would you see over and over and over? You know, he is powerful. He delivers you, has delivered you, will deliver you again. He has provided for you in the past, in the present situation, and he's going to provide for you in the future even better than he's already done. He loves you. He's faithful to you. It just permeates this section. The two big threats to Israel are not the nations. They are not the Canaanites or the Egyptians behind them. Of course, they don't have really much way to go after them now, but you know, 40 years later, maybe they do. Israel's main threats are from within. Their main threats are, one, being tempted by what the nations around them and where they're going are doing, right? Forsaking what God said to do for what they're doing. And the second threat is forgetting about what God has done for them when they become prosperous. Right? When they get to Canaan, when they are blessed with the things God has for them. Those seem to be the two big threats that Moses, he kind of bounces between in this section. Between deal with temptation and then deal with forgetfulness. The two solutions are, one, wipe out the temptation, right? Gone. And then remember, right? Remember. I heard it said one time, covenants are made with promises and maintained by memory, right? And for them to keep that in their minds and benefit, they're going to have to keep reminding themselves. We read in the last section how when your son comes up and asks you, what do all these things mean? You're going to start the memory cycle again with them. You're going to have to remember those things.
When he's discussing an issue, chapters are the ingredient necessary for Israel to cultivate sufficient thankfulness and gratitude, a sense of indebtedness.
Exactly. But you're right, that's the end.
It is what he's giving you. He wants us to remember that you need to know what you lack before and what you have now, because it's not.
Yep. They're going to need to remember that, because all these Israelites aren't going to live forever. And so they're going to have to relearn that, recycle it to their kids. Okay, a couple minutes left. Let's at least look at some things. What do you think an Israelite should have learned hearing this from Moses or reading this after the fact? What should an Israelite have come away from this section knowing?
That they're about to be extremely blessed, and
they better say they aren't. Yeah, they are getting ready. You wonder, it had to have been hard to believe, you know, that this really could be that. And then the blessing of getting to go to Canaan and see it's exactly like that and more. You know, it has to be just astounding. But you guys need to take measures to defend that. All right, what else did you see? Something an Israelite would have learned from this. God's dependable. I think you learn more about God here than you do about Israel. And that's true for many Bible passages, but especially here. It's nothing that we didn't know already as we've read through, but it gets repeated again and with beautiful details. You know, you're going to learn much about who God is, that He is faithful. Okay, what else? Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. This is priming the pump. I mean, we're getting ready to go, you know. They're literally getting ready to cross over and to go in. It makes it even more sad that the speaker can't go. He's made that point already a few times. But you can hear excitement in these words for them, and with it, caution. You know, it can't just be bridled, yay, or unbridled. It has to be measured. Here are a couple more. Israelite reading this, hearing it, goes, you know, maybe I ought to cut down those temptations that God mentioned. Those sound like a really serious threat. And that's exactly what they were. It wound up being their downfall, among other. The two things that Moses mentions don't do here, they do. They forget, and then they allow the idols to come in. Got to cut those things down. Got to get rid of them. Look to God, don't look to yourself. It didn't come from you. You didn't do it for yourself. God gave it to you. So that needs to sway your allegiance to Him and really go from there. Anyway, really lessons we could all learn, I'm sure. It's a lot of times I just go through the interpretations and I find New Testament connections for the same thing, because it usually is the case. You can find passages like, you know, God's chosen us as His people. You know, look what God did. Don't look to yourself. All those sorts of things. But we're out of time. Next week is only chapter 9. So look forward to looking at that with you. A bit of a shorter section. So we'll be able to get some more details out. All right. Thank you, guys.